I'm Jerry Evenrude. For 21 years, I was a parish musician in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, at Grace Lutheran Church. We had many different churches in Eau Claire, and several of the Lutheran persuasion. There was Trinity Lutheran and Good Shepherd. The church I served, Grace Lutheran, was a very large church, almost 5,000 members, and down the street in the next block was another church called First, and there were about 4,500 there. And we always used to joke, to help people to understand at what church each of us worked, we would say, you can go to First, but you're saved by grace. I mentioned that one time to the pastor of First, and he said, yes, but seek ye first. So names you have problems with. Last September, I was asked to work with our national office of the American Lutheran Church. And I've put up some symbols here. The ALC, for those of you who are not into Lutheranism, is the American Lutheran Church. And I happen to work for a division of the American Lutheran Church, which is the DLMC, which is the Division for Life and Missions to the Congregation. And my area, in terms of mission of the congregation, is in the area of music and the arts. In addition to the ALC, we have the Lutheran Church in America. The ALC offices are in Minneapolis. The Lutheran Church in America, some of the offices are in New York City, and some of the other offices are in Philadelphia. And so that has a little bit more eastern orientation. And then the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which now also has some more letters with it. Is it St. Louis, Missouri? Well, back in 1965, I brought along with me a Xerox for a copy of a Missouri publication from Michigan. It's called The Catechism on the New Hymnal. And the first question is this. Who took the first action to have an all-Lutheran hymnal? The answer, the Lutheran Church. Way back then, 1977, voted to ask the other Lutheran bodies in the United States and Canada to join in the production of a new hymnal. Now, at this retreat center, we use the Red Book. This was completed in 1958. Well, in 1965, we had just been in the book for a short time. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod invited the Lutheran Church in America and the American Lutheran Church to join them and produce a new hymnal. And at that time, after that convention, was formed another group called the Inter-Lutheran, IL, Commission on Worship. The Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship. That involved representatives from three bodies, the American Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church of America, and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, plus representatives from Canada. So there was another Lutheran Church now involved. When the ILCW began to organize its work, it realized there were two major areas that we would be involved in if we were producing a hymnal. One would be liturgical materials, and another would be materials relating to the hymn section. And so the ILCW divided itself into four working committees. The liturgical text committee, the liturgical music committee, the hymn text committee, and the hymn music committee. They have now completed their work. The final work is now done. And all the notes are in, all the words are in, and most of the comments and periods are in. And they are now being processed in a very efficient manner by Oxford Publishing House, and it is expected that the book will be ready for use in congregations by Advent 1978.
When this book was introduced in 1958, I can remember as a parish musician being asked to go to a meeting in Chicago and receive information at that meeting to enable me to share information in Wisconsin, in the state of Wisconsin, that would help congregations to use the book effectively. I had not seen any material in this book until I arrived in Chicago, nor had anybody else who had not been on the committee. And when we looked at the book, for most of the people that were there, it was the first time in about that we had seen the book. That was the way the committee operated. When the green book, and that is the color now, when the green book arrives in 1978, there will have been more people that have seen more of the material of the book, and it has been tested more than any other hymn book ever to be produced in the United States, Canada, Liechtenstein, or Norway. An entirely different process applied to the development of the book. What you have in your hands is one of those products. This was the first ILCW publication and was a paperback hymnal, sort of in this paperback disposable age. The idea of this paperback hymnal was to enable congregations to sing some hymns that were not in the Red Book, and it also made it possible for us to share with congregations why it was necessary every 10 or 20 years to produce a new book. If you will look at hymn number 10, I think you'll get a little idea of what I'm talking about. It's very difficult if you have a hymnal that has all its materials before World War II to talk about the atom, because we really didn't know very much about the atom. It's very difficult to talk very much about outer space. We knew outer space was there, but we were not exploring it. And once a hymnal has been bound, it's very difficult to insert new material. And so this is one example. God who stretched the spangled heavens infinite in time and place, flung the suns in burning radiance through the silent fields of space, we thy children in thy likeness share inventive powers with thee, great creator, still creating, teach us what we yet may be. And this is sort of the ongoing prayer of creative people who are in the church, constantly thinking about creating new ways of worshiping, new materials to use in worship. Let's sing this hymn. It's an exciting one.
Tune one.
Thank you.
we are going to use that book, how we are going to introduce that book, and some of the contents of that book, I'd like to share with you. I've just come from question.
Did the 1969 have some significance?
That's just when we were published. Thank you for the question. That was the first publication of ILS 7. And then since 1969, that's 2003, 2004, one was a collection of baptism and hymns and communion, and then there were several liturgical orders. Another publication was CW6.
We are now involved in a three-year lectionary. Instead of having the same gospel year after year after year, we have, for a particular Sunday, a three-year span, A, B, C. And that is also involved in another set of the alphabet I have up here. The Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship early in its work decided that it would be appropriate to involve itself in the work of an international organization called the International Consultation on Ecumenical Texts. And so some of the liturgical portion of our of our hymn book has been determined by that decision of the Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship, the ILCW, to incorporate texts that are in common by all English-speaking people, not only those on this side, but also in England and other parts of the world. And while we are concerning ourselves with the involvement of not only three Lutheran groups in America plus Canada, but also this international organization, if you've had anything to do with committee work, you start thinking about, well, especially the Norwegians and Swedes in this group, maybe, and Germans in this group and this group, ethnic groups that are very concerned about getting a certain hymn in the book, or a certain style of liturgy, and then having the words determined by an international group. What happens to all that? We have to see the book in that light. And we'll discuss that a little bit later. Yes?
I think there were six that has a three liturgical, or
this is a lectionary, yes.
Is something going to be published which describes each of those texts as the worship of something that some congregations get from us, or is an answer to the book? That's just the text. The
good, yes. I'm certain there will be. There are many spin-offs, and we'll also discuss some of the spin-offs from the book, that will be eventually prepared, and some of them will be prepared so they can be used when the book is introduced in December of 78. Already. International Consultation on Ecumenical Texts. International Consultation on Ecumenical Texts. We live in a world of letters, you know, that American Lutherans, we have ALCW, that's American Lutherans, who are under the umbrella of the Division for Life and Mission and Congregation of the ALC. We have one bishop in North Dakota who has a 15-minute presentation on the ALC, the ELNC with ALCW, who have using text from the ICBT, which is prepared by the ILCW, but it just rattles on for 15 minutes of the abbreviations. You really have to be with it. But unfortunately, that's what we have to do. Okay? There's another series of letters I'd also like to mention. I think this is rather important. The Lutheran Society for Worship, Music, and the Arts. Before the ILCW was in 1965, there was cooperation. Unofficially, by artists, musicians,
people involved in liturgy were interested in ways in which the arts could embody worship. And they formed an organization called the Society for Worshipers in the Arts. Very interesting. Many of the contexts, many of the introductions that were made at that time of people from Belgrade, St. Olaf, Luther College, the colleges of the LCA, resulted in lasting friendships, and also resulted in the fact that many of the people who were formulating this organization eventually officially became part of the ILCW organization. And the transition from something that was an informal organization became something that became more involved in the political life of the church. But maybe there are valuable contributions and input into the life of worship. The three worship representatives of the ALCA, the Church of Missouri Synod, have for several years been sponsoring every summer worship conferences.
20 years ago, again as a parish musician, I was asked to go to a summer music workshop. And at that summer music workshop, which happened to be in La Crosse, Wisconsin, Oscar Overby was the choral director. Dr. Lawrence Field from Luther Seminary in St. Paul was our liturgical expert. And I was asked to do work in organ. Our audience consisted of parish choir directors and organists, period. This was the arrangement for summer workshops, and that arrangement continued for several years. Then we started getting feedback that the choir directors and organists would go back to their congregations and would have some of these newfangled ideas about worship and about ways incorporating music in the worship, and they were having difficulty with their pastors. They weren't seeing eye to eye. They weren't hearing ear to ear or whatever. And so in the last 5-6 years now, we have been encouraging pastors to attend with their organists and choir directors these music workshops. And we've changed the name to worship conferences. Well, that's been helping a little bit, but it's also been growing. The last 2 years, we have encouraged not only the pastor and the musician, but also those lay people in the congregation who are directly involved in planning for worship to attend the conference. This year, we have 10 conferences planned for the United States. We had hoped for at least an average of 100 people at each conference, so that would make the grand total of 1,000. Before I left the office 2 weeks ago, we had over 1,200 that had registered, 200 over our desired goal, and they were certain that it was going to go much higher than that. Something is happening in terms of interest in matters relating to the worship life of the church. The attractive brochure that came with a very interesting logo, the designer puts the cross in the center, and the spin-offs from that cross tell us about the action. This is the center of the week, and it goes into, permeates all of life. The title for this summer's conference is called Worship, Consequential Encounter. Sunday dawns, and the Lord's faithful followers have but one thought. They want to go to church, to that assembly of believers, where they shall share in the liturgy of the word and sacrament. It's the event that makes Sunday different from all other days. It's the event that makes prayer and praise different from all other times of devotion. That weekly liturgy is an event of consequence for the Christian community. Through word and sacrament, God takes the initiative to make things happen to his people, a new sensitivity to his love and grace. You heard about love just a little bit ago. At least you're going to hear about four loves. A new vision of his power and majesty, a new understanding of his will, a new impulse to be his witness in the world. Through word and sacrament, the faithful join the hosts of heaven to worship and adore the Holy Trinity for the gifts of life and salvation. That event, called worship, continues to be the center of parish life. It touches, transforms, and activates everything a congregation does as the community of the redeemed. That event is of such import to God and to his people that it deserves a high investment of study, planning, preparation, and creativity. These ingredients, working as agents of the Holy Spirit, enable the liturgy to become what it promises to be, a consequential encounter of God and his people, a purposeful reunion of the family of God. Well, how does this consequential encounter happen? From 2 Timothy, first chapter, verses 6 and 7. I remind you to stir into flame the gift of God bestowed when my hands were laid on you. The Spirit God has given us, no cowardly spirit, but rather one that makes us strong, loving, and wise. That's the title of a book, Strong, Loving, and Wise. And I'd like to share with you now just a sampling of what has happened in the last 5 years. I think it's very important that we realize there are many factors that are shaping our new hymnal. I would hope the most important factor that's shaping that hymnal is the gospel, our concern for sharing the gospel, our concern for proclaiming the gospel, our concern for intensifying the words of the gospel. But there are many other factors that are also shaping. And I think part of that is this whole ecumenical movement that is involving itself much more in worship. One of the agencies is a group called the Liturgical Conference, which has its headquarters in Washington, D.C. They're a very active group that are working in terms of liturgical renewal. And this particular book is addressed to those that are presiding in the liturgy. Ways in which the actions and the ways in which the presider appears before those who are involved in worship, ways in which those actions, those presiding events, shape the consciousness of those people who are involved in worship. That's one. There are different ministries. Especially in American Protestant churches, we have thought of the minister, or the pastor, or the preacher, as being the one that's primarily responsible for worship. I can remember the first pastor that I worked with in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, back in 1955. He had just arrived in Eau Claire from a smaller parish in southern Minnesota. And he said, when he went to that parish, and he only stayed there about 4 years, he had a meeting the first week with the Board of Trustees. And he asked one of the members in the Board of Trustees, I guess it was the chairman, he said, would you open the meeting with prayer? And the chairman said to him, that's what we're paying you for. That mentality. Well, that was before 1955. Much is happening in the church since then. We're beginning to realize that there are different ministries. It's not just the pastor. Today, renewal and reform of the liturgy depend on sharing ideas, experiences, successes, and even failures. This sharing is critically important to an ongoing renewal of the church's worship. My wife and I attended a church in Minneapolis last month, and they were having a special service concerning the arts in worship, and they had commissioned for that year a special event. They were going to have a harpsichord, and so they commissioned a harpsichord builder to build the harpsichord. Then they had the chairman of the art department of Augsburg College paint on the underside of the cover his interpretation of Psalm 150 on the Sunday of the opening of the arts festival. They started the service with harpsichord, flute, and violin music. Just beautiful. Followed by brass and organ music. Followed by the McAllister College bagpipe band, which led the procession. Well, that was just kind of super exciting, because that the acoustic of the room was marvelous, and if you've ever heard bagpipes, you know one bagpipe alone is enough. But get a whole band going in a reverberant space. Well, I had goosebumps going up and down my arm and could hardly sing. I could hardly hold back the tears. It was so exciting. But it wasn't just the sound. I'm a musician, so I, you know, naturally would get excited about sound. But it was also the visual impact of that procession. And one of those banners, they had several, but one was pure white. Woven banner. Beautiful white. And I'd never seen this before. The banner bearer, in procession, moved the banner so the white banner was flowing toward the front of the church, toward the chancel area. Terribly exciting. Well, later on in the service, they had an offertory, and they did an anthem. The choir sang an anthem. Oh, excuse me. We still have the bagpipes. Okay, the bagpipes finally led everybody up to the chancel. And then when the choirs got up there, in addition to the harpsichord that day, they were also dedicating a set of handbells. And the organist had written a composition, so all the handbells went smash, and the choir said, "This is the day the Lord hath made, let us rejoice and be glad." You know, I mean, it was, you know, from harpsichord and flute and violin to brass organ to bagpipe to handbells. Quite a smorgasbord there. The recessional was also, well, then at the offertory time, a beautiful anthem was sung, and then they had four dancers interpreting it. And, you know, you almost became exhausted by the time the service was over. There was so much going on. But it was a conscious effort to employ all of sense, all the senses of sound and sight and movement and textures in worship. The recessional, back to the bagpipes. They started out their drone and out they went. And we followed. And when we got outside, they were forming for the children circles, and they were dancing to bagpipe music out on the green. The service did not stop with the recessional. The service was just helping us get back into life again and providing even more celebration. Well, that took planning. We went back to that same church on Pentecost. They were really into kites. They had a kite, white kite banner. But on Pentecost Sunday, the education department had involved the children in making kites over a period of 2 or 3 weeks. And they put appropriate scripture verses on their kites and designs and symbols on their kites, which relate to Pentecost. And they had a recessional. And when they got outside, with kite in hand in procession, they let their kites go up into the air. Not all the kites made it, but some did. And it was an exciting moment, and they'll never forget Pentecost. Well, that's part of liturgical renewal. These are different ministries. involving all senses. Worship is corporate action. You can't have public worship without liturgy. And so the ALC provided with Mandus Egge a pamphlet that's called How to Involve People in Planning and Leading Worship. Or another, pamphlet by Mandus Egge says, worship is corporate action. Worship is involving people in worship planning. Worship is involving people in worship preparation. Worship is involving people in the doing with no spectators. We talked back a while about that Minnesota congregation, Southern Minnesota congregation, where the chairman of the board of trustees thought the pastor was paid for. His salary was paid to him so that he would take care of the praying. And there are people, I guess, that think that their role on Sunday morning is to be a spectator. Well, liturgical renewal is an attempt to involve more people. I think the most exciting book I've read about involving people in worship, at least the most exciting title, comes from Holland. And it's by Bernard Hubers. And he talks about the congregation, and his title for the congregation is The Performing Audience. Ever gone to a concert? You're a spectator. Ever gone to a church? You're a performing audience. So think about that. All these factors, you know, we have to put into the mill. This is what is shaping our liturgy, shaping what is happening, shaping this book that will be published in 1978. Everyone who is part of the joyful song to the Lord is esteemed and challenged, most especially the congregation itself, the performing audience. Or another book, The Church of Christ Has Always Been a Pilgrim Church, a church on the way. I remember once somebody said they really thought the architect who designed the church in the form of a tent really understood what church architecture was about. It remains our task to constantly seek new and fuller expressions of worship. Our community prayer remains in process, alive, saved from stagnation. When you have a whole note to sing, and I've been a choral director for a long time, lu. If you do not fill that lu with air and support it, lu, it just falls into nothing. And so it is with our liturgies. If we don't keep filling them with new ideas, they fall into a state of stagnation. As a pilgrim people, we are ever developing. I've had several people ask, we have a fine hymn book, the binding isn't worn out yet. What is the necessity? You know, well, it's getting a little bit there. What is the necessity for a new hymn book? Every 10 or 20 years, I think, it should be necessary to update the book or at least have additional supplementary materials. The language changes. One of the reasons for the new book is so that we will be more comfortable with those of other denominations who are using the ISIL International Constitution of International Text. This language is something. Since this book is published, we have become aware that women are women in a new dimension. And we even noticed last evening, as our woman pastor, you couldn't follow what she was reading because she was changing. And she was changing because there is a need to update the language. That consciousness was not a part of our frame of reference before, or at least most people's frame of reference before 1958. And so another need for change. But good things just don't happen. We have to plan for them. This same group I talked about, the liturgical conference in Washington, D.C., provides a delightful set of resources. This happens to be the one for the period we're in right now, summertime 1977. And in it is they include just papers. Here's here's a series of papers for families on vacation, or the parish picnic, or planning for Sunday liturgies, or a guide for the parish team, or a little outline that will be used by this committee. People in the parish, the organist, the choir director, the lay people that are involved in worship, the pastor, the prayer booklet, movement prayers. You ever had any dance or movement in your church? Vacation prayers, fairy tales, spoken word, music, movement, festivals, occasions. Great time to plan for a picnic, bulletin, but all that has to be planned for. And that's what that resource is all about. What I'm saying is people are becoming aware that congregations are beginning to develop within their structure committees that are planning for worship. And therefore, we have a proliferation of materials that are available to help that committee do its work. Here's another, comes from the LCA. Planning parish worship. One reason for this, to help congregations in the introduction of new materials from ILCW, the Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship. Okay? Another, the rediscovery of concepts and practices that have been part of the broad stream of Christian tradition, especially in the Western Church. I talked to you earlier about the conference that I was at in Texas that was planned by the three bodies, the ALC, the LCA, and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, a worship conference that was addressing itself to people who are involved in planning worship, not just pastors and musicians, but also those lay people who are worship leaders. For the first time in my life, I went to a foot washing service. That had not been part of my experience in liturgy. I went to that service I was very skeptical about how that service would add to my spiritual life. I had read the service before I went, and I was still skeptical. During the conference last week, we were attempting to introduce and share and explain some of the new rites that will be in the Lutheran Book of Worship. One of those rites happens to be a foot washing service for Thursday of Holy Week, set in the context of a liturgical service, where just before the act of foot washing occurs, we hear from the Gospel that account of the first Thursday when that very event did occur. And then to see four people chosen from the congregation who sat on four chairs facing each other in front of the chancel, to see the pastor take off his robes, put on an apron, bring a towel and basin, kneel down, and wash those feet, made a profound impact on most of the people that were there. We'll remember Thursday. And we'll remember that spirit that was obviously a part of our Lord's when he was involved in that. And the liturgy was shaped by the Gospel. I think I've had moments in my life when I've felt that there have been people who are interested in liturgy who sit in ivory towers or seminary offices who shape liturgy. That's too bad if that happens. But if I can feel that those people who are in responsible positions are attempting to shape a liturgy that reflects the Gospel, and through testing, in congregations, and in consultation with people in many areas, with people who are interested in the field of music and the arts, interested in English language, interested in semantics, interested in form and function and architecture, all those factors considered, interested in background and heritage, then that begins to shape a book. I feel that's the way the Lutheran Book of Worship is being shaped. Now, when a book is shaped that way, we cannot expect the ideal book. I'd like to, you know, stand in front of you and say, the Lutheran Book of Worship is going to be the greatest book of worship that has ever existed. I cannot say that, because it was formed by a committee. It was brought together by too many divergent groups. But it is going to be the best book possible at this time under those restrictive conditions. And I think we need not make any apology for that at all. This is an important milestone in Lutheran relationships. We know that Missouri invited ALC and LCA to join them in 1965. We have also heard now that there is some rumbling that maybe they might not approve the book at their convention in Dallas this summer. But whether they approve the book or not, they still have shared with us their tremendous heritage. I'm going to miss some hymns that I had hoped would be in the book. I was even on the hymn music committee of the ILCW for a little over a year. And one of my favorite hymns that I introduced to Holden Village at the time of the Vietnam War, I so wanted to have in that book. It's appeared in several other books now since that time when I had it in manuscript. But because the committee was very sensitive about reaction from, and we have to think about that, that's another factor. Over half of the churches of all the bodies are in cities of less than 1,500 and congregations of 200 or so. And so we have many people that are using that book who have limited technical facility. And it so happened that hymn was a little difficult to play, at least to sight read. And so it was not included. Sensitive to those issues. But the book still will do what it set out to do, and that is provide a book of worship for all three Lutheran bodies in the United States and the Lutheran Church in Canada. Question? Sure.
Well, you mean you said you're going to miss the hymn. Is there any kind of encouragement, when you talk a lot about diversity and supplements and stuff like that, ways to encourage congregations to keep their readiness? I mean, not necessarily use the service, but to, you know, to use the music, to use the service, but not power for everyone? Because that happened when the red one came out. You know,
Let me share with you one idea that came up in the committee. And of course, this is difficult to do because we were thinking only in terms of those that had the red service book and hymnal, but the Missouri Lutheran people have another book. But somebody suggested, let's not publish any hymns at all in the new book that are in the Lutheran Book of Worship, and let's have all new hymns. And then the congregations could keep and have two hymn books. And then they just think of the number of hymns we could have. If we had, you know, we'd have almost 900 hymns that we could use. But I think that's a good idea. If congregations have the service book and hymnal and they're getting the new book, save both books. There are some hymns, for example, O Day Full of Grace. That didn't make it in the service book and hymnal. It was in the Concordia, for those of you who know the Norwegian book. But now it's back in. But I think one of the stanzas has been altered a little bit. But it's going to be an important addition to the new book. Yes.
Lander or Klum, that then it was a beat to have all those hundreds of red hymnals over my head now. In view of the fact that the new hymnal is coming out.
Yeah. You think they probably should have stopped publication? Okay. Something curious about Lutherans. And something great about them, I guess. The bishops of the Lutheran Church or the national office of the Lutheran Church will not tell your congregation what service to use or what hymnal to use. That's a local decision. We will provide materials. The National Office will provide materials, as we're doing now with this new Lutheran Book of Worship. I was out in Eureka, South Dakota in April. Big congregation in a small town. They didn't buy into the service book and hymnal. They were still using a book from 1920. And they're worshiping, and it's a vital congregation, and that's great. If they, you know, if they can function that way, there are just some of us that feel that it's necessary in terms of the ongoing life of the parish to update the hymnal, service book and hymnal periodically. And so for those who are into that mentality, then they can stay in the Lutheran Church and do just that. For those that aren't, they can continue to use the service book and hymnal and buy it. Now, I'm not certain about the publication schedule. I don't know if they're publishing anymore that book, but I know it's still available, and I know that people are still buying it. And it's a good book. Nothing wrong with it at all. From my point of view, the Lutheran Book of Worship is just a little bit more exciting. But that's my own subjective appraisal. And so that's another thing. I think if you're in a congregation that isn't interested in the new Lutheran Book of Worship, for example, this summer, most of the consequential encounter worship conferences are dealing with a new worship book. But at the beginning of the week, we tell everybody who's there, what we're interested in is in worship, not just the book, Lutheran Book of Worship. That happens to be a book that we're using, but what we're most interested in is the worship life of the parish. And if your parish finds that it can, in its budget and in its plans, include Lutheran Book of Worship, we think that it'll be an exciting venture, an exciting resource to use. But it certainly, and is recommended, but it is not necessary. Yes?
You've mentioned all kinds of different exciting resources for worship. Is there any kind of bibliography of publishers, at least, if not publications?
I think I could have a limited number available. Mm-hmm. How long are you going to be here? You leaving? Okay, good. I'll see that you get one. Mm-hmm. Yes? Yeah, I hope to get into both the liturgical section and the hymn section. If there's some interest right now in that, I'd like to share with you a little bit what has been done in terms of liturgy. Do we go until the bell, till 12? Okay. In the service book and hymnal, there are two musical settings, for those of you who are into that. And then there is a third option that is available, a Gregorian setting. So there really are three. In the Lutheran Book of Worship, there will be four. One setting is by the musical setting is by Hillert. These are all now services of the Word and Sacrament, the full service, called the service of Holy Communion. The first setting by Hillert, a professor of music near Chicago at River Forest. The second setting by Ron Nelson, a parish musician from Westwood Lutheran Church in St. Louis Park, for those of you who are here from Minneapolis, which is reflects our hymn heritage, and a third setting, which is an adaptation because of these ICET texts of what we already have in the second setting by Mrs. Frixell from Rock Island, where Beanie Lundholm is from, who was the organist here this summer. Adapted by Gayhard Cartford, who was at the seminary at St. Paul. Those are the three settings. Then, Martin Luther, of course, was very interested in hymns. He wrote some. And as he was poring over liturgical forms, he suggested it might be a good idea to have a lead messa, hymn settings. And so instead of having liturgical song, he substitutes, like, glory be to God on high, all glory be to God, is substituted instead. And so you can go through the service and have just hymns sung. So that would be a fourth setting. That's the liturgical portion of the church. Now, of the Sunday service. Then when Contemporary 9 came out, which is just recently, it included the daily prayer of the church, which involves what we had called before Matins, it is now called morning prayer, and what we had called Vespers is now called evening prayer, and prayer at the close of the day, Compline, responsive prayer, suffrages, responsive prayer too at other times, the litany, psalms, and so forth. More liturgical material. Then in addition to that is are the innovative services, such as the foot washing service for Thursday, the Easter Vigil, the service, you know, we've always had Christmas Eve services, but we have never had Easter Eve services. And now there is an order for Easter. I was stationed in Germany back in 1954, and I spent Easter week, Holy Week, with a German family, and on Saturday evening, they, at midnight, went to their church. The church was all dark. And I started hearing striking. And I said, what's that sound? They said, oh, that's the striking the flint. They're lighting the Paschal candle. And at the stroke of midnight, in they walked with that candle, and everybody in the church had candles, lit the place, became a blaze, got to the chancel, and the all the lights in this magnificent church came on. The organist started playing, crashing chords, and they abruptly stopped, and the pastor said, Christus ist erstanden. And we were launched off into the liturgy of a glorious Easter Vigil. Well, I got back to the States, and we had sunrise services. And they're fine, and I never thought anything about it. And, but in the Lutheran Book of Worship is provided an opportunity for that service, an Easter Vigil service. Also for baptisms and for the burial of the dead and marriage and an extensive list of rubrics to help people help worship planning committees organize, prepare, and plan not just for the word, but for the visual impact, for the motion impact, and for the sound impact. Do you have any specific questions about the liturgy?
Well, sometimes I think that having so many settings defeats the purpose of having a hymnal that all of you can use, because so often your congregation can use one setting more than others. Mm-hmm. And that one doesn't have to go on vacation because another congregation be totally lost in the third setting. So to have a lack of education on the part of the leadership of your own home church, if they don't have
yeah. I think part of it, again, goes back to this.
ALC, LCA, Lutheran Church is very simple.
It's an attempt, at least we have the same text now. At least we have the same order, and each congregation might not use exactly the same music. However, We find that those churches that change services, at least in terms of seasons, find it very refreshing to not sing the same. There's an old Swedish tradition. In fact, I kind of wish that we could have gotten into that, where there was a setting for each season. We have a composer in Minneapolis, John Ilvesacker, who has come up with an interesting idea, and I think some of these might be supplementary publications that will also be available to congregations. For example, for one season in the church year, to take the season of Epiphany, he will have the liturgy set to spirituals. And for another, he'll have it set to gospel hymns for the Lenten season. For the Easter season, he'll use Lutheran chorales only. And just another way of... And then when you come back to the first setting or the second setting, the setting that you're using in your church, you come back with, I think, fresh ears and can appreciate, hopefully, the change a little bit. It depends upon the mindset of the congregation. If your congregation is thinking in the way of doing it, you know, the way great-grandparents did it, then that is a challenge. But if somehow the pastor and the committees have been able to free the people, also to see that within the service there can be variety. You know, that maybe every Sunday we will not sing the Gloria in Excelsis. Maybe some Sunday instead of the offertory something else is going to happen. And that the rigid stance that many congregations take of never deviating from the prescribed liturgy it is suggested in the rubrics in this liturgy that there be more flexibility and hopefully encouraging some creativity within the structure. Yes? There have been some requests from the group that is not with the Missouri Synod right now, but was with them. What is the AELC group? And I think that they are very interested in the material. And many of the people who are in the AELC have contributed a great deal to the development of this book. But as far as I know, there's nothing officially has happened in terms of their relationship. But I think that many of their congregations will be using the book. Yes?
Along that same line, in Minnesota, there's in Wisconsin, there's quite a small group of Wisconsin students. Have they done anything with this?
I do not know if they have been involved or not. Yes, anything else? We talked a little bit about spin-offs from the book. And I'll be going over some of these hymns tonight when we meet. I've forgotten now what time is. But this is, I think, over 30-some hymns from the Lutheran Book of Worship called A Festival of Hymns. And the idea of the record is to provide a resource for families to become better acquainted at home with the melodies and sounds and words of the hymn before the hymn is introduced into the congregation. Now, you know, talk about advanced planning. The book is coming out in December 1978, and we already have a record. Okay. The idea of the record is also to help musicians hear ways in which they might introduce some of these hymns, not just with the pipe organ or the electronic organ, but also with flutes or strings or harmonica. There's one of them with a harmonica in the introduction. Or various ways in which hymns might be used. There's a children's choir in the record for part of it. There is an adult choir of, I think, 16 voices. And they wanted a congregational sound. And they said, how are we going to get a congregational sound? You know, they really don't want a congregational sound because there's too much coughing in the congregation and a few monotones and that sort of thing. But how do you get a congregational sound? And you can't hire, 500 people. That would cost too much. So they take, at the sound studio in Minneapolis, they take 16 people and they sing a hymn, okay? Prior to that time, they had recorded an organ. So then they play the tape of the organ and the 16 voices sing with the organ. Okay, so then when they get through with that, then the 16 people listen to themselves and sing again, and that's 32. And then the 32 listen to that, and that's 64, and it multiplies. The professional jargon for that is malt one, malt two, and I just love ice cream, and I thought that was an interesting way of describing it, malt three, and so that's how we get a congregation from 16 people. Well, that's kind of fun. So that's it's an exciting record, and I'll share some of the sounds with you later on this week. Yes?
Question I have about the liturgical section. Has an effort been made to eliminate a lot of the flipping back and forth?
Oh, thank you for that question, yeah. Oh, isn't that praying hand kind of nice up there? The format of the book was also tested. People said, oh, we don't like turning pages, so many pages, and skipping around so much. And so the topographical format was given to three designers. Two of the designers were Lutheran, and one, I think, was the Covenant or Baptist Church, which had nothing to do with liturgical form as we know it. And guess who got the contract? The Lutheran designers came back with the same old difficult maze to follow. And the person from the other non-liturgical denomination came up with a format that includes red for the rubrics. Rubrics mean red, all these indications as to what you're to do, the road signs, okay? And then, if there are alternates, they are very clearly, and you can come up and look after, they're clearly outlined. And so it says, most merciful God, on this side you might do that, or you might do this, and there's an or in between. And it was very interesting when we were working with this last week down in Texas. It was not necessary for the pastor or the presider of the service to say, we will now do the column on the left side instead of the right side. Would you please turn to page 4, and now please stay on the left side, not the right side, and don't skip any pages to get to the left side or the right side, but stop it. You know, the second paragraph down on the left side, elaborate instructions like that? No. All he said was, I confess to, and everybody knew where he was. We don't need so many directions. Okay. Then you will find on the page 6 and 7 of this, there's a setting, Glory to God in the Highest, and this is the feast. Well, they're both on the same page. And it's clearly marked, Glory to God in the Highest, or. And hopefully that page layout will be the same in the bound volume. The rubrics. They're different typefaces, and I think it will be very handsome in its format. Yes?
Is there going to be a real concerted effort at the seminary that can really teach our pastors? Because I think a lot of it has to do with the people who get into the tube. And you know, the people that get to know has some kind of working knowledge. I know they do have a little bit of it, but they haven't, I guess, the first year of the seminary.
I think we're finding that our seminaries are becoming more and more interested. That means that our pastors will be more and more interested. It's an entirely different climate now than it was a few years ago. And I feel that in terms of the attendance this summer at the conferences that we've planned throughout the country, I indicated to you earlier that attendance far exceeded our expectations. And we're finding that districts all over the country are planning worship events this next year, which will involve pastors. Thank you. See you tonight.